Ezekiel chapter 38, the destruction of Gog's armies. Chapters 38 and 39 comprise a series of prophecies that have to do with events which will overtake Israel at the time of the end, and there are seven oracles, each of which is introduced with the phrase, "Thus saith the Lord." They are, one, the description of Gog's armies, two, Gog invades Israel, three, God's purpose with Gog, four, the presence of the Lord in the earth, five, the burial of Gog's army, six, the sacrificial feast, and seven, Israel restored. It is clear that chapter 38 does not follow on chronologically from the events of chapters 37, because chapter 37 ends with the kingdom established, Israel and Judah united under one king, and God's sanctuary established in their midst. The dead bones of Israel have been caused to stand upon their feet as an exceeding great army. And God's spirit is in them. To understand chapter 38, then, it is necessary to see it describing events that overtake Israel at some time prior to that happy state of things described at the end of chapter 37. As has been shown earlier, the Gogian invasion is responsible for the devastation of the modern state of Israel. And it is this, coupled with Gogian anti-Semitic policies, which causes Israel to say, "Our bones are dried and our hope is lost. We are cut off for our parts." And this 37th chapter is largely concerned with the restoration of Israel by Messiah in all the fullness of God's promises subsequent to the Gogian invasion. It is therefore fitting that the events that turn Israel into a valley of dry bones should be considered in some detail, and chapter 38 provides this. This 38th chapter has given commentators considerable difficulty, and many opt to treat it as a complicated allegory, details of which will not be given here. Now, in verse 1, we have the description of Gog's armies. And it is important to note that whoever these latter-day powers might be, they have a connection with powers in existence at the time of Ezekiel. And most of the nations listed by the prophet have already been mentioned in previous chapters. We've had Meshach and Tubal, Persia, Ethiopia, Tagama. And they were recognized by Ezekiel as being in existence in his day. Thus, when the prophet was commanded to set thy face against Gog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, it may be safely assumed that he was being bidden to address his prophecies to a known contemporary power. And we shall see that this power, the Gog of the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech and Tubal, had reference in the prophet's day to the barbaric Scythian peoples in the dark northern extremity of the then known world. Magog was the son of Japheth, and from him were descended those people known to history as the Scythians. And then the book gives a great deal of detail on these people, and he goes on to say that Gog was the leader of these descendants of Magog, because that's what is that's the significance of the description, Gog of the land of Magog. And then Rosh, this Gog of the land of Magog, was also, according to the revised version, the prince of Rosh, Meshech and Tubal. And there is a great debate among translators and commentators with respect to this phrase. The authorized version renders it chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. Whereas some object that Rosh cannot be a proper name, since there's no nation known to history as the Rosh. But these objections are hardly valid because Chilmad and Chub are also only found on one occasion. They're in Ezekiel 27 and 30, and our people's unknown to history. Well, it is granted that the Hebrew word Rosh is found frequently in the Old Testament as an adjective meaning head or chief, yet the use of the phrase here in Ezekiel demands that it be translated as a proper name. And student, Hitzig, says about this that an epithet formed by the junction of these two words is nowhere else known in the Bible, and that the full title, if it were simply a compound title, should be so formally repeated three times is rather improbable. It would appear then that Rosh is here the name of a people or country like Meshech and Tubal. And then there's a great deal of detail. Many, many commentators are quoted. And the section concludes: from the evidence presented, which is quite voluminous, it would appear that in Ezekiel's day, the Rosh or Scythi were a nomadic people who had settled in an extensive area northwards from the northern shores of the Black Sea. And he quotes P. Schwarzkopf, who states that Rosh refers to the territory which approximates the modern Ukraine rather than Russia as we know it today. According to most, if not all, historians, the territory now known as the Ukraine was once known as Rus by the Greeks and Rus by the Europeans and Arabs. It is not surprising to find an eminent Russian historian stating, as an introduction to Russian history proper, we must turn to the northern shores of the Black Sea and to the steppe beyond. Territory that we would refer to as the Ukraine and southern Russia. In commenting on the word Rosh, Jesenius states that it refers undoubtedly to the Russians, who are mentioned by the Byzantine writers of the 10th century under the name of the Rus. And Stanley, in his History of the Jewish Church, says concerning Ezekiel 38, here, first in any historic record is the only indication which the Bible contains of any modern European nation. The mighty people of Russia, through this wild Scythian invasion, has won a place in the sacred books. Moving on now to Meshech and Tubal. They are the sons of Japheth, and they are mentioned in Ezekiel 27 and 32, where they are presented as a warlike people engaged in the export of slaves and copper to the Phoenicians. Herodotus referred to Meshech and Tubal in the name time of Darius and Xerxes, as the Moshi and Tiberinoi. Bocart speaks of them as a barbarous people of Asia inhabiting what was known as the Moshian Mountains between the Black and Caspian Seas. In Old Testament times, they were part of the Scythian host that brought about the fall of the Assyrian Empire, and they appear frequently in the Assyrian inscriptions as the Mushkai and Tabali, and are known to have moved southwards and settled temporarily in Asia near the northwestern side of Assyria. With the fall of Assyria and the rise of Babylon and Persia, the Mushkai were subdued, and there can be little doubt that large numbers of them were pushed northwards beyond the Caucasus, where they resumed a nomadic existence, wandering over the northern steppe lands, mingling with the other Scythians, and there they became known as the Muscovs, and gave their name to the Russian nation and its ancient capital. And a similar fate, no doubt, overtook the Tiberini. Josephus identifies Tubal with the Iberians, a people which, with the Moshi, then inhabited a tract of country between the Caspian and the Black Seas, which approximates to modern Georgia. Thus, in the time of Ezekiel, Meshech and Tubal would roughly correspond to modern Georgia, Armenia, and perhaps parts of Turkey. At this point, the question needs to be considered as to whether or not there is in these Bible names a reference to the modern names of Russia: Rosh, Moscow, Meshech, and Tobolsky, Tubal. Certainly an oversimplification to say, for example, that the city of Tobolsky in Siberia derived its name from Tubal, the son of Japheth, for the city of Tobolsky was not founded until 1587. However, it seems quite reasonable to argue that the name of Tubal was carried by his descendants when they migrated into the region we now call Siberia, and that it was their name that at some stage became attached to a river, the river Tobol, from whence the name of the city of Tobolsky was ultimately derived. The suggestion that Russia is derived from the word Rosh is not in favour of most modern Western historians and commentators. They maintain that the word Russia in Russian Russia is derived through the Slavonic Rus, a name first given to Scandinavian settlers on the Dnieper in the 9th century AD from an earlier form, Ruotsi, a Finnish name for the Swedes. However, the dogmatism exhibited by the moderns is unwarranted, and Ryasanovsky reviews the evidence for a Scandinavian origin of the word Russia, and he makes the point that the role of the Normans, that is the Scandinavian Northmen, in the establishment of the Kievan state, the early Russian state that is, itself remains highly controversial. And the question of the Kievan state is closely connected with a group of tribal people known as the Rus, and it is also from Rus that we derive the later name Russians. And there's quite a bit of detail here. And he then, the writer then, Brother Orfrey then says, at this point it must be emphasized that the identification of Gog, of the land of Magog, with modern Russia does not rest simply on the similarity of the word Rosh to Russia. We identify the power with Russia because she is the modern power which, with her confederate independent states, occupies today the territories of the ancient Scythians, that is, the Magog known to Ezekiel. Moving on now to Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya, there's never been any real doubt as to the identity of them. Persia is not mentioned in the list of nations in Genesis 10, but throughout Scripture it is frequently associated with the Medes, who were descended from Japheth, and together they founded the Medo-Persian Empire. Japheth had a son called Madai. Persia was beginning to come to prominence in the time of Ezekiel, and the Scythian invasion of Assyria, to which we have referred, resulted in a weakening of Median influences in the post-Assyrian Middle Eastern milieu. From then on, the Persians were moving towards a dominant role in Middle East affairs, a position which was finally achieved at the end of Israel's 70 years captivity when Cyrus became the ruler of Medo-Persia. And at the time, Ezekiel gave this prophecy. The Medes and Persians occupied territory that corresponds to modern Iran, but would also have included parts of southern Turkestan and Afghanistan. Ethiopia, the word is Cush in the Hebrew, and Libya, the word is Phut in the Hebrew, were both descended from Ham. The Cushites migrated in two streams, one going into East Africa, occupying the territories of modern Sudan and Ethiopia, the other stream going towards India. In the Bible, when Cush is mentioned, it is usually the African section of the descendants of Cush to which reference is made. Josephus places it south of Egypt, beyond Syene, and this accords with Ezekiel 29, verse 10 in the AB margin, and it corresponds more or less to modern Sudan and Ethiopia. In view of the anti-Semitic role here allotted to this people in the prophecy, the recent exodus from Ethiopia of the Falasha Jews is of interest. The descendants of Phut, once Libya, eventually moved into North Africa, west of Egypt, into the territory of modern Libya, but probably covering a much wider area of the African continent, especially in the north. So in the time of Ezekiel, Ethiopia and Libya would relate to countries to the south and west of Egypt. Gomer and Togarmah. Well, Gomer was a son of Japheth, and Togarmah was Gomer's son, and the descendants of Gomer are mentioned in the Assyrian inscriptions as the Gemarei, who were known to the Greeks as the Cimmeri. These Cimmerians are mentioned a number of times by Herodotus, from whom we learn that they originated north of the Black Sea. And Smith writes that the Cimmerians were a people who unquestionably came from the region now called the Ukraine. Josephus informs us that Gomer founded those whom the Greeks now call Galatians or Gauls, but were then called Gomerites. Small bodies of Cimmerians had entered Asia Minor from earliest times with their Thracian allies from the west by the way of the Hellespont and the Bosporus. And carrying on a little bit further, thus at the time Ezekiel delivered his prophecy, these descendants of Gomer were wandering over a great part of what we know today as Western Europe. In summary, then, this confederacy of nations which is to come against Israel will at least include, in modern terms, the following. Gog of the land of Magog, prince of Rosh, Meshech and Tubal, which is Russia and her confederates, and Persia, Ethiopia and Libya, which would correspond to what we call Iran, Sudan and Ethiopia, Libya, almost certainly other North African nations, and the eastern migration of Cush means that it is possible that nations from the Indian subcontinent may be involved. Gomer corresponds to a number of Western European nations, especially Spain, France, Italy, and Germany. Eastern Euro nations which have thrown off, possibly only temporarily, the Russian yoke also belong to Gomer's so-called bands. And Togarmah is now Turkey. This then is the Confederacy of Nations to be led by Gog of the land of Magog. And he's now challenged at verse 7. Be thou prepared, yea, prepare thyself, thou and all thy companies. In the words of Joel, prepare war, wake up the mighty men. Let all the men of war draw near. No matter how diligent the preparation, no matter how careful the battle plans are thought through, the outcome is foreknown and assured. Gog and his forces will fall on the mountains of Israel. Like the Assyrians of old, Gog's work is divinely appointed. I will send him against an hypocritical nation, against the people of my wrath will I give him a charge to take the spoil and to take the prey. The Assyrian came against Judah in the days of Hezekiah. The cities of Judah were devastated. Hezekiah and a remnant were shut up in Jerusalem and had to endure the taunts of Rabshakeh. But God heard the prayers of his servant and addressed the might of Sennacherib. Because thy rage against me and thy tumult is come up into mine ears, therefore will I put my hook in thy nose and put my bridle in thy lips, and I will turn thee back by the way by which thou camest. Isaiah 37. For Gog, there will be no going back by the way by which thou camest. Yahweh says to Gog, I will turn thee back and put hooks into thy jaws, and I will bring thee forth, and thou shalt fall upon the mountains of Israel. It is interesting to note that all the nations referred to except Rosh and Persia are specifically mentioned in Genesis 10. Rosh, since it is so closely allied to Meshech and Tubal, would appear to belong to the Scythian people. And since Persia is connected elsewhere in scripture with the Medes, the nation is almost certainly descended from the family of Japheth, as were the Medes through Madai. And this would mean that all the nations referred to are of Japhetic or Hamitic origin. There is not one Semitic nation among them. He now draws a table, the composition of Gog's army, with three columns, Japheth, Ham, and Shem. In the Japheth column, we have Rosh, Meshech, Tubal, Gober, Gomer, Tagama, Persia. In the Ham column, Ethiopia and Libya. And in the Shem column, it's blank. And this tends to confirm the suggestion made in our consideration of chapters 25 to 28 and 35 to 36, that the neighboring Arab Semitic peoples have already entered into a period of peaceful coexistence with Israel before the Gogian invasion. And as a result of this, that Israel occupies the position described in Ezekiel 28. They shall dwell safely therein and shall build houses and plant vineyards. Yea, they shall dwell with confidence, which is precisely the picture presented in this 38th chapter at the time when Gog invades Israel. They shall dwell safely, all of them, verse 8. A land of unwalled villages that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls, and having neither bars nor gates. This prophecy has not been fulfilled in any way, at any time in history. And there's a footnote here. The idea set out by E. Whitaker in the Gogian invasion in the testimony, Volume 42, page 50, that Ezekiel 38 actually refers to the invasion during the days of Josiah, and that the words I will turn thee back is speaking of the removal of the Scythian armies from Israel in Ezekiel's day, is unlikely. There is nothing in any historical record to suggest that the Scythians were still occupying parts of Palestine and the nations around at the time when Nebuchadnezzar invaded Israel and carried Ezekiel captive, and neither Is there any suggestion that Ethiopia and Libya were confederate with the Scythians at that time, even if Persia had been subdued by the Scythians in 640 BC? After the return from Babylon, there's no record of any such invasion. Indeed, at no time in history other than our own days could such an invasion have taken place. We alone are privileged to see Israel partially restored and Russia the greatest power in Eurasia. In spite of the dismantling of the USSR and the apparent humanizing of Russia, she is still covertly pursuing a policy of world domination. There's sympathy with Russia for various reasons in most of the areas referred to by the prophet, and we shall watch in wonder as these nations are drawn closer together. And he cites the reasons in a footnote, the reasons, the sympathy with Russia. He says, including ethnic connections and a sharing of Islam between the southern CIS states and Iran, Persia, together with rabid anti-Semitism. The sharing of the ideology of dictatorship, Russian military hardware, and ardent anti-Semitism between Russia, Libya, and Ethiopia. An anti-Semitism harbored in Catholicism, shared between Gomer and Russia, and an intense dislike of Israel's effective control over religious sites. In verse 8, Gog invades Israel. And the description of Israel at this time given in verse 8 should be carefully noted. The land that is brought back from the sword. That is a land whose people have recovered from the ravages of war. And this suggests a time of peace. And they've gathered out of many peoples, not true of the return from the Babylonian captivity, and indicates that we are correct in applying the latter years, verse 8, to modern times, and Israel's gathering to that which has happened in recent history. And they shall dwell safely, coupled with a further description of Israel at the time of Gog's invasion, verses 11 to 12, as already noted above, suggests a time of peace and security which modern Israel has not yet experienced. We anticipate, as we have before maintained, that Israel will enter a period of prosperity and dominance in the Middle East prior to the Gogian invasion. He then says, the above paragraph, given in an address in the late 1960s, was first published in 1978. It was in the Bible Student on volume 9, page 149. And he says, it is encouraging to note that since then, Israel, negotiating from the position of strength attained by her past military victories over the Arabs, has signed peace treaties with Egypt and Jordan, has entered into a peace accord with her arch foes, the Palestinians, and has commenced negotiations with Syria, which will clearly include Lebanon on the basis of scriptures previously examined, and the picture of a settled and prosperous community presented here in Ezekiel 38. Much is yet to be achieved by either further conquest or negotiation. And at this point, further comment must be made on the fact that at this time, Israel is said to dwell safely, verse 8 and 11. This is taken by some to imply that Israel has at this time entered into the blessings of the kingdom and that Messiah is already reigning in Zion at the time of the Gogian invasion. For example, Dudley Fifield, in the New Bible Student, Volume 3, page 91, it's an article, What Shall Befall Israel in the Latter Days? Now, it is acknowledged that the idea of Israel dwelling safely, and that is Hebrew as bitach or bitach, is used of the blessed state of Israel in the kingdom in such scriptures as Jeremiah 23, 33, Ezekiel 34. However, it is the context in which the word is found that determines whether or not the kingdom is being referred to, not the use of the word bitach itself. And in each of the following uses of the word, we would never see implied an enjoyment of kingdom blessings. In Ezekiel 30 at verse 9, the Ethiopians are said to dwell in a careless, that is, bitach way. Hazor is described as dwelling without care, that is, bitach. We shall have neither gates nor bars which dwell alone, that's Jeremiah 49. This is very reminiscent of the words used of Israel in Ezekiel 38. And in Isaiah 47, the Chaldeans are said to dwell carelessly or securely in the RB margin. Again, the Hebrew is bitach. And guided by the context in each of these references, the use of the word bitach, safely, implies nothing more than a time of perceived but unwarranted security. In each case, the dwelling safely was short-lived and interrupted by a time of intense trouble. And so will it be with Israel prior to the Gogian invasion. The Gogian invasion will be the punishment for all their trespasses, whereby they have trespassed against me, when they dwelt safely in their land, and none made them afraid. Ezekiel 39. Like the Ethiopians, the inhabitants of Hazor and the Chaldeans, Israel dwelling safely in the time of Ezekiel 38 implies no more than that the nation is enjoying a period of peace and is unaware of the impending invasion that is about to overwhelm them from the north. And this time of peace, however, will be shattered by Gog and his armies coming like a storm, like a mighty hurricane into the land of Israel. Verse 9. And some indication has been given of the prosperity that is likely to accrue as the result of the peace accord between Israel and the surrounding Arab nations. It will be the prosperity of the nation of Israel, the desirability of the conquest of that strategically important land, and an ingrained anti-Semitism that will cause Gog to think an evil thought and go to war against the state of Israel. It's worth commenting at this point on the statement that Gog will ascend, verse 9, or go up, verse 11. It's the same Hebrew word in both places. Against Israel. It's been argued from these statements that in order to go up to Israel, Gog must be in the south, for one would only use the phrase go up if one were traveling north. Thus it is said that the invasion of Israel by the northern power called the King of the North in Daniel 11 takes place after he has invaded Egypt. Daniel 11 verse 42. However, the phrase go up does not indicate movement in a northerly direction. When Cyrus gave the Jews permission to return from Babylon to Jerusalem, he said, "Who is there? Let him go up to Jerusalem." Similarly, the nations in the kingdom, regardless of their geographical location, will be required to go up from year to year to worship the king. Thus, there is no reason why the invasion of Israel by the King of the North should not take place as he descends through the land towards Egypt, just as the Scythian hordes in the time of Josiah occupied Bethshan on their way to Egypt. And certainly, this is the order of events at a plain reading of Daniel 11 conveys. The There is here added detail not found in Ezekiel. The powerful invading army is presented just the same, but in addition we are informed that many ships will be involved in the invasion. This confirms the fact that Turkey will be a part of the Gogian Confederacy, because for Russia to use many ships against a Middle Eastern power would necessitate the free passage of those ships through the Bosphorus. The intention of the invader is clear: to take a prey, to carry away silver and gold, to take away cattle and goods, to take a great spoil. Gog will therefore seek to occupy the land of Israel. In this he will be successful, and this is made plain from other parallel prophecies, such as Zechariah 14 and especially Daniel 11, where we are informed that the northern invader shall plant the tabernacle of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Regarding the free passage of Russian ships through the Bosphorus, as a footnote, in a sense, Russia was the main victor in the 67 war between Israel and the Arabs, for her ships then sailed unchallenged through the Bosphorus into the Mediterranean and have done so ever since. Thus, Russia obtained, without firing a shot, what she has always longed for: free passage into the Mediterranean waters. And the alliance of Tagama with Gog shows that at the time of the Gogian invasion, this facility will still be available to the northern invader. At this point in Ezekiel's prophecy, another group of nations are introduced into the picture: Sheba and Dedan, merchants of Tarshish, with all the young lions thereof, shall say unto thee, Art thou come to take a spoil? It's now necessary to try to identify these nations. Sheba and Dedan are descended from Ham through Cush, and there's also a Sheba and Dedan descended from Abraham through Keturah. It is impossible to be sure which Sheba and Dedan are referred to in the various Old Testament passages which speak of nations carrying these names, and since both the Hamitic Sheba and Dedan and the Abrahamic or Semitic Sheba and Dedan appear to have settled in the Arabian Peninsula. But it's of no great importance. Sheba and Dedan point to the inhabitants of the Arabian Peninsula. And this leads us to consider a remarkable sign of the times, because Saudi Arabia is an emerging, potentially powerful, very rich nation. And during the heyday of the Soviet Union, when the USSR had bases and or influence in Libya, the Sudan and Iran, and at one time even in Egypt, in Saudi Arabia there was not even an illegal communist party operating within her borders, and the situation in Russia has changed, and her expansionist aims have been put on hold, but we can expect to see Russian interests and influence rekindled in the nations surrounding Saudi Arabia. On the other hand, we shall expect to see Saudi Arabia's ties with the UK and USA becoming stronger. Tarshish was descended from Japheth through Jarban. He gave his name to the people who in Old Testament time settled the western end of the known Mediterranean world. An Assyrian description from the time of Esarhaddon states that in consequence of his victories over Tyre and Egypt, all the kings of the islands from Cyprus as far as Tarsisi paid him tribute, which, since Cyprus is in the eastern Mediterranean, so suggests that Tarsisi or Tarshish was to be looked for in the west. Jonah boarded a ship at Joppa, now known as Jaffa in Israel, to go to Tarshish as he fled from Nineveh. And this too suggests a place in the western Mediterranean. The Phoenicians traded with Tarshish, which Tyre being on the eastern shore of the Mediterranean, again suggests that Tarshish is in the western part of the Mediterranean. This conclusion is endorsed by most commentators and historians. Most are agreed that the allusion is to Tartessus in Spain. Tartessus appears to have been the name of a city and a region, what we know as Spain. The Tarshish of the Hebrews and the Tartessus of the Greeks may be taken to include all they knew of Spain and perhaps the western regions within and without the Straits of Gibraltar. But while the name Tarshish was connected to this region of Spain, it seems that it embraced far more. The quotation above applies it to areas without the straits. And the Phoenicians, who regularly went to trade with Tarshish in silver, iron, tin and lead, certainly passed through the straits, and there can be little doubt that they worked the tin and lead mines in Cornwall and the Scilly Islands. And besides the British Isles, the Phoenician navigators traded to others in the Atlantic called the Ostromenides, which are probably the Azores. The northwest coast of Africa was occupied at several points. There's an interesting reference to Tarshish when we learn that Solomon Hiram, king of Tyre, had a navy at Ezion Geber in the Gulf of Aqaba, and these ships went to Tarshish and returned with gold and silvery ivory, apes and peacocks, and this gave rise to the concept of an eastern as well as a western Tarshish. The political circumstances of the time led our early brethren to identify this with India, which was part of the British Empire. However, it has been argued that ships of Tarshish simply mean ships built for long sea voyages, and that the ships did not go to Tarshish, the limits of the known Western world, but to Ophir in southern Arabia. The words in 2 Chronicles 9, translated "the king's ships went to Tarshish," it is argued, are probably better translated as "the king had Tarshish ships." And so the NIV gives "the king had a fleet of trading ships manned by Hiram's men." However, even if we accept, as the author is inclined to do, that the authorized version of 2 Chronicles 9 is correct, and the ships went to Tarshish, it is by no means definite that an eastern Tarshish is intended. And since Tarshish was normally reached by the western Mediterranean, this may suggest that Solomon's navy went to Tarshish either by canal from the Red Sea to the Mediterranean, and there is some suggestion that a canal existed, or they went round the African continent, reaching the northwest African coast. In the time of Pharaoh Necho, Phoenician sailors, at his bidding, circumnavigated the African continent. Human nature being what it is highly unlikely that, having accomplished this and seen the richness of the African lands, they could have resisted the temptation to extend their interests along these shores. In the time of Ezekiel, then, Tarshish was the extreme western world as known to those trading nations, and included all the territories we have mentioned: southwest Spain, northwest Africa, and trading islands beyond the straits. There's been much discussion over the years as to the identity of the Tarshish of Ezekiel 38. since Britain and the USA are the major powers that have emerged in the latter years, in the territory of the ancient Tarshish, that is the extreme west of the known world, it seems to be quite reasonable to suggest that Britain and perhaps the USA are referred to by the prophet. And the involvement of the UK and the USA with the development of Saudi Arabia serves to reinforce this viewpoint. The way in which they had the willing cooperation of Saudi Arabia in the Gulf War further serves to underline the closeness of the modern Tarshish powers with latter-day Sheba and Dedan. And these events may well herald the development of that alliance to be revealed at the appropriate time. The Sheba, Dedan, and the merchants of Tarshish will say, "Art thou come to take a spoil?" The events also offer an indication of the nature of their response to the Gogian threat. The placing in the Arabian Peninsula of American and British military forces. All the young lions. Footnote here, the NIV, NASB and RSB all render young lions as villages. In this they follow the Septuagint and repoint the Masoretic text to read that way, but most commentators favour the translation young lions, and they've been mentioned earlier in Ezekiel chapter 19, where they represented Israel's leaders. And it is tempting to see the young lions in chapter 38 as referring to cooperation between the Sheba, Dedan and Tarshish powers on the one hand, and certain leaders of Israel, the young lions, on the other. A cooperation which was indeed in evidence in the Gulf War, when Israel's leaders, at the request of the USA, agreed not to retaliate against Iraq's Scud missiles. But the Hebrew will not allow this interpretation. The sense of the Hebrew is that the young lions belong to Tarshish. So the versions translate. The merchants of Tarshish with all their strong lions, NIV margin. The traders of Tarshish with all her young lions, Rotherham. The merchants of Tarshish with all its young lions, NASB margin. And the traders of Tarshish and all its young lions, JER. It would seem reasonable that the young lions refer to those countries which, with Sheba and Dedan, form an alliance with the Tarshish power, and at the present time the member nations of the British Commonwealth appear to be those most likely to be so designated, and some consider the USA to be one of the young lions rather than it being included in Tarshish. This whole scenario would suggest that in the events depicted in Ezekiel 38, at the time of the end, the sympathies of Britain will be with her Commonwealth allies and with the USA and not with Europe. This writer is inclined to the view that Britain may well leave or be forced to leave the EU, which at the time of writing appears under German influence to be heading towards a political United States of Europe. Verse 14, God's purpose with Gog. Gog's invasion of Israel is to take place at a time when my people of Israel dwelleth safely. The word translated safely, Hebrew betach, is from a root that means to feel secure, to be unconcerned. And although there are occasions when the feeling of security is so unwarranted as to amount to carelessness, yet the way in which the word is usually used is to convey the idea of a fully justified feeling of security. So in the reign of Solomon, Judah and Israel dwelt safely, every man under his vine and under his fig tree. And this appears to be the sense here in Ezekiel 38. And the means whereby this position of safety is achieved has already been considered in chapter 35 and 28. In the prosecution of his campaign against Israel, Gog comes out of the north parts. And the importance of this statement cannot be overemphasized. Moscow is due north of Jerusalem. Thus, the identification of Gog with the power of Russia is geographically substantiated. Those who object to the identification of Gog with Russia must supply an alternative power north of Israel, able to do the work that the prophet assigns to Gog. And the great message of these verses is that the future movements of Russia and her allies are the result of the divine hand at work with them, an illustration of the fundamental teaching of Scripture that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men. Circumstances surrounding the movements of the nations are supervised by the angels who, working in the context of man's free will, ensure the progress of the divine purpose. It's difficult for us to enter into the wonder of this. Russian foreign policy will be developed by the powers in Russia, and the decision to invade the Middle East will be made by the Russian leaders of their own volition in response to circumstances that appear to call for such an action. But when that decision is made, it will be made at exactly the right time and in a way mapped out beforehand in the prophets. Thus God says, I will bring thee against my land. Verse 16, it is indeed God's land. Although he has allowed it to be trodden down of the Gentiles for centuries, this will be the time when, says God, I will remember the land. And the result of the Gogian invasion will be that the nations will know me when I shall be sanctified in the O Gog before their eyes. And thus history will again repeat itself. And of Pharaoh it was said, for this cause have I raised thee up, or to show in thee my power. And so it will be with Gog. Verse 17, we have the presence of the Lord in the earth. Art thou he of whom I have spoken in old time by my servants the prophets? Ezekiel was not the only prophet to speak of the attitude of Gog towards God's people and the subsequent humiliation of the invader. The first nation to fight against Israel during a journey from Egypt to the land of promise was Amalek. And of this encounter, Balaam was compelled to write, Amalek was the first of the nations to fight against Israel, but his latter end shall be that he shall perish forever. It's clear that there's far more in this expression of God's intentions than the annihilation of the Amalekites. To celebrate the victory of Israel over the Amalekites, an altar was to be erected. It was to be named Yahweh Nissi, Yahweh my ensign. And the reason why it was so called is explained, because the hand of Amalek is against the throne of the Lord. Therefore, the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. The implication in this is that the war with Amalek would proceed apace when Yahweh revealed himself as Israel's ensign. And this he did when he sent his son, who lived a life of obedience and was finally lifted up onto the pole. The Hebrew word is nes, which means the ensign. As Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, thus he destroyed in himself the diabolos principle which energized the Amalekite nation and which motivates and guides those who prosecute that anti-Semitic, anti-throne of Yahweh war which Amalek began. Being successful in this fundamental battle against sin, Jesus became the one appointed to fight against the Amalek principle politically manifested. He is the ensign to which his future assistance in that conflict rally. The root of Jesse, which stands for an ensign of the peoples, unto whom the faithful of the Gentiles now seek. The Gogian Confederacy on the mountains of Israel is the latter-day manifestation of Amalek. It is in his destruction that the words of Balaam will at last be fulfilled. His latter end shall be that he perish forever. It is no coincidence that Balaam also spoke of the time when the shout of a king will be among them. That is Israel. And of this time his, that is Israel's, king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. Thus, in the earliest of the prophets, that is in old time, verse 17, God spoke of the humiliation of Gog, the latter-day champion of the Amalekite cause, and this great theme subsequently formed the basis of many a prophetic message, and this should lead us to view with extreme caution those explanations of Ezekiel 38 that relate it to a different time, to the great future theophanies referred to in scriptures such as Joel 3 and Habakkuk 3 that were given before Ezekiel's, and to those such as Zechariah 14 given after. All of these are expansions of those early predictions of Moses and Balaam. When Gog touches Israel, he touches the apple, that is the pupil of God's eye. And there is in consequence a vigorous reaction. My fury, says God, shall come up in my face, and there will be in consequence a great shaking in the land of Israel. The shaking takes place as a result of God's presence being revealed in the land. In Old Testament times, the presence of God was revealed through that angel concerning whom God declared, "My name is in him." He was called the angel of God's presence. At this future manifestation of divine power, the name bearer will be the Lord Jesus Christ. He will come in the name of Yahweh, in fulfillment of his promise to Israel. "You shall not see me henceforth till ye shall say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord." Thus all the latter-day prophecies of the Old Testament that speak of the Lord or Yahweh manifesting himself in power on behalf of Israel, including Zechariah 14, Isaiah 66, Joel 3, are actually foretelling the coming of the Lord Jesus into the political arena. And this shaking in the land of Israel will indeed be political. For the pictures in the prophets indicate that Yahweh will use the powers of nature, earthquake, pestilence, rain, hail, etc., to bring about the greatest political upheaval of all time. And the parallels here with Habakkuk 3, Joel 3, and Zechariah 14 are striking. And there can be no doubt that they all refer to the same event. And here he has a table with Ezekiel 38, Habakkuk 3, Joel 3, and Zechariah 14 showing several corresponding passages. The presence of Yahweh from Ezekiel, the chariots of salvation in Habakkuk, Yahweh's mighty ones in Joel, and Yahweh's feet in Zechariah all denote the emergence into the world of politics of Christ and his saints, whose work will be to execute upon them, that is Gog and his armies, the judgments written. It should be noted most carefully that these prophetic chapters are not speaking of the return of Jesus back to the earth, but of his active emergence with the saints into the world of politics. Jesus will have returned long before to judge the household and organize the saints for the great work before them. And faced with such omnipotence, where the powers of nature are harnessed by the one unto whom all power has been given, Gog's armies will fall to pieces like the Midianites in the time of Gideon. Panic will seize the armies of Gog so that every man's sword shall be against his brother. And the worldwide implications of the manipulation of the powers of nature that will be used to destroy Gog's armies will be discussed at chapter 39. And at this point, we mention the fact that steep places or towers in the Authorized Version margin shall fall, and every wall shall fall to the ground. Verse 20. This may well be part of the cleansing process whereby all the churches and other so-called holy places will be removed from the land. And the eyes of the nations will thus be directed to the great victory achieved on behalf of the remnant of Israel by Yahweh their King. With great interest, amazement, and in some quarters apprehension and antagonism, the nations will watch as the King of Israel begins to rule in the midst of his enemies. and with his brethren he commences the long-awaited task of raising Zion from the dust.